This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is meeting with Vladimir Putin in Russia, where Kim is expected to push the Russian president for economic aid, specifically relief from international sanctions that remain in place after nuclear talks with the United States broke down. Thursday's summit reflects Russia's effort to position itself as an essential player in the North Korean nuclear standoff. Dmitry Trenin, director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, says Putin will use the summit to elevate his profile on Korean matters.
Russia wants to essentially send a message, not just to Washington and to a degree to Beijing, but also to Seoul, that it is an important player and Russia should be factored in when Korean issues are discussed.
A Kremlin advisor told Russian news agencies that the Kim-Putin summit will focus on North Korea's nuclear program. Tropical cyclone Kenneth, a powerful storm brewing in the Indian Ocean, is expected to strengthen as it heads toward the East African coast near the border between Mozambique and Tanzania. The storm comes as Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe struggle to recover from last month's devastating cyclone Idai. Major international aid agencies have been helping with the recovery from Idai, which struck March 14th, and they are now preparing for Cyclone Kenneth. The current storm presents new challenges to the recovery from Cyclone Idai, whose massive flooding killed at least 800 people and displaced tens of thousands of others among Mozambique, Malawi, and Tanzania. As always, for more news, please join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Special Counsel Robert Mueller concluding that Russia engaged in sweeping and systematic interference in the 2016 U.S. election to help Donald Trump become president. But a new account says the issue is still too sensitive to discuss in front of Trump as it relates to what Moscow might do when he runs for re-election in 2020. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Former Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen took it on herself to formulate cyber and election security strategy after being advised to avoid the topic in meetings with President Donald Trump. That's according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity. The guidance came from Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who wanted to keep White House meetings concentrated on the president's top political agenda, border security. But Nielsen convened classified meetings on cyber and election security with agency heads, and there were cross-government strategy sessions with FBI, Justice Department, and intelligence officials. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Measles in the United States has climbed to its highest level in 25 years, closing in on 700 cases this year, and a resurgence largely attributed to misinformation that is turning patients against vaccines. Roughly three-quarters of this year's illnesses in the U.S. have been in New York State, mainly in two ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities in Brooklyn and suburban Rockland County. Dr. Joseph Kaplowitz is a pediatrician at a clinic in Brooklyn, which serves the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in that city.
The problem is that we have this, this microcosm, this small number of people who are making a lot of noise in terms of to try to get people to at least be on the fence. So therefore, we do have patients delaying. And that's even what we see from, like I said, from the Department of Health data that I mentioned before, which is showing that there is delays in the ages between 1 to 4, where half the cases are taking place. And that's really the target zone that we're trying to work on.
Dr. Kaplowitz says while he has seen an increase in the number of patients looking to become immunized since the city imposed a mandatory vaccination policy in several zip codes, there are a number of people who continue to spread misinformation about vaccines. There have been three measles-related deaths reported in the U.S. since 2000. And the United Nations has evacuated just over 300 Libyan refugees from a government-run detention center in Tripoli after some were allegedly attacked for protesting bad conditions. Fighting between rival governments in Libya has made living in and near the capital extremely hazardous for civilians. Along with a call for an immediate ceasefire, humanitarian officials from the UN said they urgently need more than $10 million to continue helping beleaguered civilians in Libya. For more news, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Refugee Agency says it evacuated about 325 refugees from a government-run detention center in Tripoli.
Libya remains a country that is not safe for refugees, for persons who need international protection. Therefore, we are hoping countries will help us to take them out of Libya into a safe environment.
Paula Barrachina is the UNHCR spokesperson. Sudan protesters have called for a million people march today, Thursday, in support of a civilian council. A former Gambian military junta commander has appeared before the country's truth commission. Burundi seeks admission into SADC, and a judge in Sierra Leone has sentenced a former deputy minister to 3 years or pay a fine of 250 million leones.
Mr. Abdou Barry was awarding contract for the refurbishment of government properties to this enterprise, and he did not at any point in time disclose his interest in this business, which caused a huge loss to government.
Patrick Sande is the Director of Public Relations for Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission, and a South Sudan police chief warns of the presence of gangs in the capital, Juba. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says Wednesday it evacuated about 325 refugees from a government detention center in Tripoli amid deteriorating security and escalating violence in Libya. In a press release, the agency said the relocation was triggered by reports of the use of armed violence against detainees who were protesting the conditions in which they were being held. Fighting between rival governments in Libya has made living in and near the capital extremely hazardous for civilians. African leaders meeting in Cairo on Tuesday called for an immediate and unconditional halt to the fighting in Libya. UNHCR spokesperson Paula Barrachina says the deteriorating security situation in Libya makes it imperative for refugees and migrants to immediately be provided a pathway to safety.
Today, UNHCR jointly with IOM evacuated over 325 refugees and migrants who were trapped in the detention center in the south of Tripoli, Gaster Bengasir. The area had been under clashes and continues to be under clashes. So today, we managed to relocate these very vulnerable refugees and migrants from Gaster Bengasir to Azawiya Center, where they are now safe, out of harm. Our teams are there as we speak right now. They're delivering humanitarian assistance, also providing medical assistance, and registration for those persons of concern to UNHCR.
Where did you relocate the refugees? Inside Libya or outside Libya?
Now we have relocated them inside of Libya, but we are calling on the international community to provide humanitarian evacuation out of Libya. Libya remains a country that is not safe for refugees, for persons who need international protection. And therefore, we are hoping countries will help us to take them out of Libya into a safe environment. At the moment, there are 6,000 refugees and migrants who are detained in Libya, and 3,500 refugees are still located in areas of active conflict. Therefore, it is very important to ensure that we can take them out of Libya so that they can be safe.
How would you describe the humanitarian situation inside Libya?
The humanitarian situation inside Libya remains extremely concerning. There's over 35,000 Libyans who are currently displaced due to the conflict, in addition to the 58,000 refugees who live in the urban context and are, many of them, located in areas of clashes. Therefore, UNHCR is providing humanitarian assistance to all displaced persons, as well as refugees who are in need. We are also very concerned about the situation of refugees who are trapped in detention centers in areas of clashes.
These refugees that you have evacuated, are they Libyans or other Africans?
The refugees who are in detention center are mostly of African origin. Refugees are coming from Sudan, from Eritrea, from Somalia, as well as from Ethiopia.
Thank you very much, Paula.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Paula Barrichina is the spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency. She spoke with me from Libya's capital, Tripoli. A judge in Sierra Leone has sentenced a former deputy minister to 3 years for corruption or pay a fine of 250 million leones, an equivalent of about $28,000. Abdul Barry, former deputy minister of Works, Housing and Infrastructure, is on trial for 7 counts of corruption. He pleaded guilty to 1 count for awarding contracts for the refurbishing of various government properties to a company which he jointly owns with his wife, but without disclosing his connections. Patrick Sandy is the director of public relations for Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. He says Mr. Barry may not have to go to jail if he pays the fine within 30 days starting from April 24, although he still faces other charges.
Basically, Mr. Abdul Barry, when he was the deputy minister, he jointly owned an enterprise which is called Riba Enterprise, himself and his wife. And so what happened, he was awarding contracts for the refurbishment of government properties to this enterprise. And he did not at any point in time disclose his interest in this business, which caused a huge loss to government because an amount of about $11 billion was involved in the award of those contracts to Riba Enterprises for the refurbishment of government properties. So he was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment, or he pays a fine of 250 million leones.
Mr. Sandy, that is very confusing, at least to me, and I hope to other people. Does this mean that if he pays this fine, he may not have to serve jail sentence?
Yes, on just this one count, which he has pleaded guilty, the judge ordered that if he chose to pay the fine of 250 million leones, he should do so within 30 days from the 24th of April. Otherwise, he goes straight to serve the 3 years jail term.
Now, some people will say that by doing that, you are allowing people like him to get away with it because people like him might have taken a lot of money from the Sierra Leone people. Maybe serving a jail time may teach some lesson.
Yes, but you should also note that the trial is still in progress on the other counts. And we should also note here that this is just on one count. And this particular fine of 250 million on one count is unprecedented in the sense that we have seen sentences being handed down on one count of offense when the person is guilty of 30 million leones. But the fact that this time we've had on one count when somebody has pleaded guilty, he is fined 250 million leones and given a period of time to pay, which is 30 days. Otherwise, he serves the jail term. I want to believe it is quite an unprecedented in the fight against corruption, and particularly relating to sentences that have been handed down in the past relating to anti-corruption cases.
Now, in your release, you've made an appeal to other public office holders who might be in control of public resources. Are you following other high-profile cases?
Yes, we are. Because you realize that quite a huge chunk of public resources are given to public officials. And in most cases, these resources are not being used appropriately. A case in point could even be the officials of the Ministry of Information that are also giving funds for sensitization on the Commission of Inquiry. And it goes on and on. So we are also advising all those who have been given public resources to make sure that in this application, you go by the laid down procedures and the regulations.
Mr. Sandy, thank you very much. We are happy to speak with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Patrick Sandy is the Director of Public Relations for Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 25th, Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. The number two man in Gambia's former military junta, Sana Nsabali, on Wednesday appeared before the country's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission. Sabali admitted he coordinated and participated in the execution of dozens of Gambian soldiers and senior army officers in November 1994. The soldiers were accused of plotting to overthrow Yahya Jammeh's military junta, Pandere Umbai reports.
Former Junta Vice Chairman Sana Bairo Sabali has been explaining to the TRC the role he had played in suppressing the November 11, 1994 abortive coup.
I addressed the men, the officers and men who were there, that here is the information. We are going to attack an enemy, an unknown enemy, we said, because we don't know who exactly they were. Inasmuch as also, we did not know whether they had any external support. I said, now, we have a situation in hand. We cannot wait for the enemy to come and attack us in our house. We have to meet them where they are.
Sabali had served as Junta Vice Chairman from July 22, 1994 to January of 1995. He parted company with Jammeh after he and the late Interior Minister, Sadibou Haidara, were accused of plotting to overthrow the regime. Haidara later died in jail, while Sabali got released after serving 9 years behind bars. During his sustain with the junta, Sabali had been accused of torture and killing of military detainees. He had launched an appeal through the TRRC by asking his victims to forgive him. Sabali also says when Jammeh wanted to join him to quell the November 11 coup, he told Jammeh to stay at the state house and help steer the affairs of the state.
At this particular point in time, Jammeh said he was going to go also. I said, no, you are not going to go. You stay behind and hold the rear. If in case we are captured or we are dead, you continue the mission. And eventually he accepted to stay behind.
SR Fall is the lead counsel for Gambia's TRRC. Fall told Sabali that he was responsible for the massacre of some army officers who were arrested in connection with the November 11 failed coup.
You violated the laws of this country.
Right, correct.
You committed murder.
Correct.
You executed 6 Gambian soldiers in the most gruesome manner.
Correct.
All of you council members are guilty of that murder.
Correct.
Sabali tells the TRRC that the alleged coupists had planned to execute all the council members and their families. He also says during war situation, the Geneva Convention doesn't apply in the case of the captured officers. Sabali's statement had attracted the attention of the chairman of the commission, Dr. Lamine Cisse, a former United Nations official.
Shocked and bewildered to hear you say that the Geneva Conventions are nothing. It's a bit surprising that a commentary like that would come from my own country here and from a platform of TRRC. I think that compromises, to a certain extent in my view, the integrity of the work that we are doing here.
Cisse says the Geneva Convention had required nations to respect the rights of prisoners of war, but Sabali was still adamant on his position.
I don't think anywhere in this world militaries obey these Geneva Conventions. We have seen the examples, Americans, how they're handling Afghanistan. We have seen how they handle everywhere in the world. This is what I exactly wanted to put across.
Sabali also claims that he is a victim of the former military junta he had served. He says he was tortured while in jail. He also claimed that his life was attempted shortly after he was released from prison. He had to leave the country for neighboring Senegal before traveling to Germany. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is pandering by reporting.
Sudan's protest leaders have called for a 1 million people march today, Thursday, to demand the ruling Transitional Military Council give power to a civilian council. The call came after the head of the military council said the council would hand over power within days if civilian groups can agree on who will be in the new government. Namba Muhyiddin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's main protest group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, has called for 1 million people to take the streets on Thursday. The head of Sudan's Congress Party, which has backed the SPA in the recent protest, says the demonstrators will not accept military rule. He said, yes, they have escalatory measures. They are ready for 1 million person march and preparing for a nationwide political strike. They will not give up the people's demand for a civilian government. On Tuesday, Sudan's army chief and head of the Transitional Military Council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah Abdurrahman Borhan, said the military would turn over power to civilians within days if the protest groups agree on the composition of a new government. Borhan made the comments during an interview with the BBC's Hard Talk program when he underscored that Sudan's troops will not attack protesters who have been camped around military headquarters since April 6. But protesters dispute Borhan's characterization that a consensus has not been reached. Protester Waddah Saleh said could be done within 1 month if the opposition parties make a united government. The list of civilian members of government has been submitted, he says. So the ball is in the military council's court and they should accept it within a month. The military ousted President Omar al-Bashir on April 11 after 3 decades in power and 4 months of anti-government protests. But protesters have continued their sit-in, demanding civilian rule, and not the military's announced two-year transition.
الفترة بتاع الثلاثة شهور دي كثيرة شديد بالنسبة للمجلس العسكري.
Protesters Amjad Nimir say that transition period is too long and they consider stalling by the military council to not hand over power to a civilian government immediately. Sudan's military is under international pressure to move more quickly to civilian rule. On Tuesday, the African Union gave the military a new three-month deadline to hand over power or have Sudan's membership suspended. The bloc had earlier given the military 15 days. The visiting U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of the State of African Affairs, Makele James, met separately Tuesday with the members of the military council and protest leaders. They discussed what the State Department has called the Sudanese people's legitimate demands for an inclusive civilian-led transition. The U.S. has said there will be no talks on lifting U.S. sanctions on Sudan for sponsoring terrorism until the military hands over power to a civilian administration. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Burundian Foreign Minister Ezekiel Umbigira met with Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Wednesday to seek support for Burundi's admission into the 16-member Southern African Development Community, SADC. Umbigira, who is representing President Pierre Nkurunziza, told journalists at State House in Harare that he was confident Zimbabwe will support Burundi's application given the strong diplomatic and historical ties between the two countries. Kindness Paraza, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Committee, says Zimbabwe will support Burundi's bid to join SADC because it is part of efforts to promote trade among SADC member countries and Africa as a whole.
I'm sure you're aware that Burundi is part of COMESA and Zimbabwe is also part of COMESA. And also recently, our parliament, the Zimbabwe parliament, has ratified the African Continental Free Trade Area. So we are removing all the barriers, trade barriers within the continent. And it's a good idea that if they agree, our SADC leaders, to admit Burundi. It's okay, he's a brother. And in any case, he's in COMESA, and we're also in COMESA. And also, not only that, we are also going to ratify very soon another free trade area among COMESA SADC countries, also including East Africa. So it's all in order.
But some human rights groups of the opinion that SADC must not embrace Burundi because it is alleged to be abusing human rights. What is your take on this?
Burundi is part of the African Union. Burundi is part of COMESA. If there are any other misdemeanors which are offending human rights activists, surely they must go and have that sorted out with the African Union. You are aware that even within the African Union, there is a Human Rights Commission. So I think let's not mix issues. Let's have activists do their own, and this SADC does its own. In any case, SADC is going to vet this application and see whether Burundi qualifies or not.
Kindness Paraza is the chair of Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Committee. He spoke from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service. South Sudan's police chief has told parents in the capital, Juba, to be responsible, take care of their children, and prevent teenagers from getting involved in criminal activities. The Inspector General of Police says security agencies are concerned that certain groups of youth are increasingly engaged in fighting and creating instability in the city. Wake Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
Inspector General of Police General Majak Akech called a press conference in Juba to say that there are gangs of youth composed mostly of teenagers who regularly drink alcohol, fight among themselves, and sometimes even kill one another. He says the gang members often move in groups armed with machetes, knives, pangas, and other weapons. Akech says following a meeting with the various security agencies officials in Juba agreed that the youth gangs have become a security threat and must be dealt with.
We are not talking of only disciplining your children, also control of your children. So whenever you discipline your kids, and then you also control, they should not just move anyhow to go and join the other group who can be actually educate them to drink some alcohol and make any other multi-practices in the street. So they will be considered as a criminal.
Akech says from now on, police officers will consider any youth involved in gangs as criminal suspects.
And we don't want to condone this to happen in Juba. It will later on result to something else that can be a bigger thing. But it is not a major threat, but it is growing something that will lead into a security that will cost the price for us to pay as organized forces in Juba.
Akeche says 4 days ago, police arrested 34 youth, including 8 girls in Juba, involved in criminal activities such as fighting and killing. He says most of them were children aged around 12 years. Juba parent Sebit Fraser says he has heard several stories about children joining a gang commonly referred to by the N-word in Munuki and Gudele residential areas. Speaking in Arabic, Fraser says he believes some parents whose children have joined the youth gangs are negligent about disciplining their children.
The parents must talk to their children at home so that they are not indulged into gang groups. They should also enroll their children into school and should not leave their children to wander anyhow in the town so that they don't get peer groups that influence them into gang groups.
Fraser says the government also needs to play a role in thwarting gang activity, such as creating alternative programs that would keep youth productive. Akech says one of the issues the security committee discussed is the problem of vehicles with tinted glasses. He says anybody possessing a vehicle with tinted glasses should go to the traffic police office and register it, and any officer who demands money for the registration is violating his duties as an officer. Akech says the Ministry of Interior had already given directives to the Department of Customs not to allow tinted vehicles to enter South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The government of Comoros shut down schools, airports, and public offices on Wednesday as tropical cyclone Kenneth passed over the island nation with wind gusts topping 200 kilometers an hour. The storm, brewing in the Indian Ocean, is expected to strengthen as it heads towards the East African coast near the border with Mozambique and Tanzania. The storm comes as Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe struggle to recover from last month's devastating cyclone Idai. The United Nations has evacuated about 325 Libyan refugees from a government-run detention center in Tripoli after some were allegedly attacked for protesting bad conditions. Fighting between rival governments in Libya has made living and near the capital extremely hazardous for civilians. The UN Refugee Agency said its decision to urgently move the refugees out of the Kazar Ben Ghazir detention center in Tripoli was triggered by reports that some were beaten and threatened with gunshots for complaining about crowded conditions and the lack of food. A judge in Sierra Leone has sentenced a former deputy minister to 3 years for corruption or pay a fine of 250 million leones, an equivalent of about $28,000. Abdul Bari, former deputy minister of Works, Housing and Infrastructure, is on trial for 7 counts of corruption. He pleaded guilty to 1 count for awarding contracts for the refurbishing of various government properties to a company which he jointly owns with his wife, but without disclosing his connections. And that's it for this Thursday, April 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Please join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17 hours 30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their views and ideas to enlighten us all on the topic at hand. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17 hours 30 UTC on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.